and it may be that the consequent preoccupation of the educated class during its most susceptible years upon the Chinese classics gave it a bias in favour of this traditional learning upon which it had spent so much time and energy. Few men who have toiled to build up any system of knowledge in their minds will willingly scrap it in favour of something strange and new. This disposition is as characteristic of the West as of the East. It's shown as markedly by the scholars of the British and American universities as by any Chinese mandarins. And the British, at the present time, in spite of the great and manifest advantages in popular education and national propaganda the change would give them, refuse to make any move from their present barbaric orthography towards a phonetic alphabet and spelling. The peculiarities of the Chinese script and the educational system arising out of that script must have acted age after age as an invincible filter that favoured the plastic and scholarly mind as against the restive and originating type, and kept the latter out of positions of influence and authority. There's much that's plausible in this explanation. There have been several attempts to simplify the Chinese writing and to adopt an alphabetical system in the early days of Buddhism in China, when there was a considerable amount of translation from Sanskrit. Indian influences came near to achieving this end. Two Chinese alphabets were indeed invented, and each had some little use. But what hindered the general adoption of these, and what stands in the way of any phonetic system of Chinese writing today, is this, that while the literary script and phraseology is the same from one end of China to the other, the spoken language of the common people, both in pronunciation and in its familiar idioms, varies so widely that men from one province may be incomprehensible to men from another. There is, however, a standard Chinese, a rather bookish spoken idiom, which is generally understood by educated people, and it's upon the possibility of applying an alphabetical system of writing to this standard Chinese that the hopes of modern educational reformers in China are based at the present time. For fresh attempts are now being made to release the Chinese mind from this ancient entanglement. A Chinese alphabet has been formed. It's taught in the common schools, and newspapers and pamphlets are issued in it. And the rigid examination system that killed all intellectual initiatives has been destroyed. There has also been a considerable simplification in the direction of introducing spoken idioms into written Chinese. This makes for ease and lucidity, even in the old characters. Such Chinese is more easily read and written, and is far better adapted than classical Chinese to the needs of modern literary expression. The very success and early prosperity and general contentment of China in the past must have worked to justify in that land all the natural self-complacency and conservatism of mankind. No animal will change when its conditions are good enough for present survival, and in this matter man is still an animal. Until the 19th century, for more than 2,000 years, there was little in the history of China that could cause any serious doubts in the mind of a Chinaman of the general superiority of his own civilization to that of the rest of the world, and there was no reason apparent, therefore, for any alteration. China produced a profusion of beautiful art, some beautiful poetry, astonishing cookery, and thousands of millions of glowingly pleasant lives generation after generation. Her ships followed her marvellous inland waterways and put to sea but rarely, and then only to India or Borneo as their utmost adventure. Until the 16th century, we must remember, European seamen never sailed out into the Atlantic Ocean. The North discovery of America, the Phoenician circumnavigation of Africa, were exceptional feats. And these things were attained without any such general boredom, servitude, indignity, and misery as underlay the rule of the rich in the Roman Empire. There was much poverty, much discontent, but it wasn't massed poverty. It wasn't a necessary popular discontent. For 1,000 years, the Chinese system, though it creaked and swayed at times, seemed proof against decay. Dynastic changes there were, rebellions, phases of disorder, famines, pestilences, 2 great invasions, that set foreign dynasties upon the throne of the Son of Heaven, but no such shock as to revolutionize the order of the daily round. The emperors and dynasties might come and go. The mandarins, the examinations, the classics, and the traditions and the habitual life remained. China's civilization had already reached its culmination in the 7th century AD. Its crowning period was the Tang period, and though it continued to spread slowly and steadily into Annam, into Cambodia, into Siam, into Tibet, into Nepal, Korea, Mongolia, and Manchuria, there's henceforth little more than such geographical progress to record of it in this history for 1,000 years. 9th. In the year 629, the year after the arrival of Mohammed's envoys at Canton, and 30-odd years after the landing of Pope Gregory's missionaries in England, a certain learned and devout Buddhist named Huan Chuang started out from Xianfu, Tai Tsung's capital, upon a great journey to India. He was away 16 years. He returned in 645, and he wrote an account of his travels which is treasured as a Chinese classic. One or two points about his experiences are to be noted here because they contribute to our general review of the state of the world in the 7th century AD. Huan Chuang was as eager for marvels and as credulous as Herodotus, and without the latter writer's fine sense of history, he could never pass a monument or ruin without learning some fabulous story about it. Chinese ideas of the dignity of literature perhaps prevented him from telling us much detail of how he travelled, who were his attendants, how he was lodged, or what he ate, and how he paid his expenses, details precious to the historian. Nevertheless, he gives us a series of illuminating flashes upon China, Central Asia, and India in the period now under consideration. His journey was an enormous one. He went and came back by way of the Pamirs. He went by the northern route, crossing the desert of Gobi, passing along the southern slopes of the Tian Shan, skirting the great deep blue lake of Issyk-Kul, and so to Tashkent and Samarkand, and then more or less in the footsteps of Alexander the Great, southward to the Khyber Pass and Peshawar. He returned by the southern route, crossing the Pamirs from Afghanistan to Kashgar, and so along the line of retreat the Yuezhi had followed in the reverse direction 7 centuries before, and by Yarkand, along the slopes of the Kuen-Yilun, to rejoin his former route near the desert end of the Great Wall. Each route involved some hard mountaineering. His journeyings in India are untraceable. He was there 14 years, and he went all over the peninsula from Nepal to Ceylon. At that time, there was an imperial edict forbidding foreign travel, so that Huan Chuang started from Xianfu like an escaping criminal. There was a pursuit to prevent him carrying out his project. How he bought a lean, red-coloured horse that knew the desert paths from a strange greybeard. How he dodged a frontier guardhouse with the help of a foreign person who made him a bridge of brushwood lower down the river. How he crossed the desert, guided by the bones of men and cattle. How he saw a mirage, and how twice he narrowly escaped being shot by arrows when he was getting water near the watchtowers on the desert track, the reader will find in the Life. He lost his way in the desert of Gobi, and for 4 nights and 5 days he had no water. When he was in the mountains among the glaciers, 12 of his party were frozen to death. All this is in the Life. He tells little of it in his own account of his travels. He shows us the Turks, this new development of the Hun tradition, in possession not only of what is now Turkestan, but all along the northern route. He mentions many cities and considerable cultivation. He's entertained by various rulers, allies of, or more or less nominally tributaries to, China, and among others by the Khan of the Turks, a magnificent person in green satin, with his long hair tied with silk. The gold embroidery of this grand tent shone with a dazzling splendour. The ministers of the presence in attendance sat on mats in long rows on either side, all dressed in magnificent brocade robes, while the rest of the retinue on duty stood behind. You saw that although it was a case of a frontier ruler, yet there was an air of distinction and elegance.